Are we out of batteries, perhaps? Are we good now? Yes? Good? Okay. There we go. All right. My presentation this afternoon is going to be a little bit different because the focus of this presentation is not so much what we read in the Scripture itself. This is one of the lectures that Brother Shane Carrington would be giving if Shane was here with us. Unfortunately, as Brother Neighbors, I think, mentioned in his announcements earlier, Kelly was diagnosed with cancer not too long ago, his wife, and they had an opening to take an earlier operation at MD Anderson in Houston. Just so happened it was going to be tomorrow morning. We all understood. You all were very understanding here as well. Telling Shane and Kelly, go take care of that. That's where their focus needs to be. So she'll be having surgery, Lord willing, early in the morning. They're driving down to Houston right now. And I know they would covet your prayers, and we'll continue to do that. But this topic that Shane was given is entitled Extra-Biblical Scientific Evidence for Creation. And that's what we're going to look at this afternoon. We're not going to be turning to a lot of Bible passages, but if you're in Hebrews chapter 1, you're going to be ahead of the game, and that's where we'll be in just a few moments. One thing we forgot to do this morning: have a sheet of paper nearby with a pen. If you have any questions about any of the lectures, what we want you to do is write down your question, give it to myself, Bruce, Sean, one of the elders, or Ross. Give it to them, and we will have a question and answer session on Wednesday night. And all the questions that we get, we will do our best to answer all of them that are given. All right? But that gives us a chance to cover any material which we might have glossed over, but which you might deem important. So if you happen to have any question about anything we cover or something related to what we're covering, but maybe we didn't dwell on it long enough or we didn't even touch it, if you'll submit that to us, we'll be happy to get over and to cover that on Wednesday night. All right? I think that's all the housekeeping matters, right? Okay. Let's get into our study tonight. This afternoon, it's not night. Extra-biblical scientific evidence for God and creation. The question is there any? Right? Because what we commonly hear from our friends in the irreligious world is that science and religion are what? They're totally incompatible, and you've got to choose one or the other, but you can't have both. Brother Reeves spoke to this a little bit this morning. You're going to hear Sean develop that a little bit more as we go throughout the week as well. But as we get into this, let's talk about, and there goes my presentation, goodbye. Let's talk. Here we go. Oh, come on. Thank you. Oh, keynote quit unexpectedly. We're aware. Let's talk about what our study's about. Don't worry, I can recover. This study is not about demeaning atheism, agnosticism, theism, or any other belief system. That's not why we're here, and that's not what this study is going to do. Whether you agree with me, whether you disagree with me, it's not the point of this study this afternoon to demean anyone's belief systems. We're going to look at evidence that is before us, and we're going to look at the reasoned opinions of people who are respected across all sorts of scholarly spectrums, but the conclusions that we're going to be drawing are not designed to upset, offend, irritate anybody. It's just going to simply be where the evidence and the reasoning leads us. This study is not going to answer every question we might have. I've got 45, 50 minutes tops. I'm not going to answer every question. That's just reality. But what we can do is get a conversation started, and what we can do is kind of blow up some myths that are out there. And that's kind of where we're going to orient ourselves in this study this afternoon. This study is not going to be about which belief system is most popularly advanced or advocated by the modern scientific community. We've got all sorts of different ideas out there. We can't cover all of them. We're going to try to get as close to what mainstream is and see how that lines up with what we read in Scripture, what we see in Scripture. And then this focus is very... The focus of this study is very narrow. Is there scientific evidence outside of the Bible for the existence of God? That's where we're going. I'm going to try not to take a whole 45 minutes because I recognize we just finished lunch. And this is the kind of lunchtime coma hour some of us are already partaking. So, stick with me as long as you can. That was a little kid I pointed out, not an adult. Don't worry. Stick with me. We'll get through this. And we'll turn it over to Sean, who's going to have a really great presentation after this. Let's start here by answering this question. What is science? We hear science and the Bible are incompatible. We hear science and religion are at odds with each other. What is science? Well, very simply defined, science is the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. Aren't we all excited now? But what are the two words we're looking at there? Observation and experiment, right? That's what science is, right? Remember the hypothetical method that we had to use back in middle school, junior high, high school? You hypothesize what's going to happen, you do it, you see if everything turned out the way that you expected, and then you write down your results and you record it, you analyze it, all that kind of stuff. That's what science is. We're looking at what's going on, we're seeing why it goes on, and we're drawing conclusions from there. So are science and religion incompatible? That's one big thing we've got to answer. Are science and religion incompatible? And we're going to approach this from a couple of different ways, but the first way I want for us to approach this is by looking at some of the reasoned opinions by individuals who are respected really around the globe for their understanding in the various areas of science, whether it be anatomy, whether it be physiology, whether it be thermodynamics or whatever. What did these people believe and what did they see? For example, we can take Leonardo da Vinci, right? Leonardo da Vinci back in the 14 and the 1500s. Renowned as one of the greatest minds to have existed, right? We still see his journals and still see his writings and his ideas. What did he have to say? Leonardo da Vinci had this to say. This is a quote from the Delphi Complete Works of Leonardo da Vinci. From his Philosophical Maxims, Prayers to God, 1132. He said, I obey thee, Lord, first for the love I ought in all reason to bear thee. Secondly, for that thou canst shorten or prolong the lives of men. Thou, O God, dost sell us all good things at the price of labor. Now, I understand Leonardo da Vinci's conceptualization of God is probably vastly different than mine, as it's going to be with many of these scholarly people we look at. However, I do want us to capitalize on this reality that da Vinci here is at least admitting some sort of belief in what? In God, whether that might be defined to him as a higher being, an intelligent designer, someone who was there pre the beginning, somebody who was in control of things. We've got da Vinci ascending to the fact that he believes in what? He believed in what? To a degree, God. Not just da Vinci. How about this guy? Everybody's favorite, say it with me now, the co-founder of modern chemistry, Robert Boyle. Everyone recognizes Robert Boyle, right? What did Robert Boyle have to say? In an entry into the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, J.J. McIntosh had this to say about Boyle. He was convinced that Christianity was the religion instituted by God. Boyle was concerned that the Bible should be widely promulgated, and he devoted time and energy to having it translated into a variety of language. Again, this is Boyle, who was noted as being the father of modern chemistry. Beyond that, Boyle was quoted to have said this, the Christian religion brings mankind diverse positive benefits, such as are more clear and extensive knowledge of God and divine things, the remission of sins, the favor of God. Here you have the father of modern chemistry, and yes, that's a direct quotation, that's why the words are misspelled. I'm from Arkansas. I did remember to put on my shoes, right? We got this right. The father of modern chemistry, respected for being a brilliant mind in his time, still respected today. And here's what he is saying. I mean, this is astoundingly close to, I think, what many of us would recognize as being our understanding of God, right? Involved with the remission of sins, divine things, a benefit to human society. That's kind of the God that we've been talking about so far, right? And here's Robert Boyle confessing belief in Him. That's not just Boyle. Isaac Newton, the noted mathematician and physician, had this to say: for while comets move in very eccentric orbs in all manner of positions, blind fate could never make all the planets move one and the same way in orbs concentric, some inconsiderable irregularities excepted, which may have arisen from the mutual action of comets and planets upon one another, and which will be apt to increase till this system wants a reformation. Focus on this statement here. Blind fate could never make all the planets move one and the same way in orbs concentric. Here's somebody who knows a lot more about this material than you or I do. And he steps back observing it and says, look, to simply chalk this all up to time and chance is a poor explanation. There is something more going on here than simply poof, and it happened. And again, this isn't from a quote-unquote Church of Christ person. I don't like that language, but we'll use it accommodatively. This is from somebody who is respected in the science community. We read further. Newton saying, all these things being considered, it seems probable to me that God in the beginning formed matter in solid, massy, hard, impenetrable, movable particles of such sizes and figures and with such other properties and in such proportion to space as most conduced to the end for which He formed them. That is the very idea of what? Of a Creator God. And that is, at least in this moment, what Newton was advancing. Now, understand that these people's views were fluid at times, but I want you to see where evidence was leading them. What they saw. Here's our point. Don't lose me on it. I'm not saying believe the Bible because Newton and Boyle and all these other guys said this. Here's what I want you to see, and here's what we need to take away. Did these people see any inconsistency between science and a well-formed belief in God? There was no inconsistency for them, was there? That to say that there was a God did not just immediately blow up their scientific knowledge, their scientific connections, their scientific scholasticism. They could believe in science, they could be exercised in the sciences, and still do what? Still believe in God. Still ardently believe in a God. And in Newton's case here, and in Boyle's case, also believe in a God much in the same way as you or I would today. Is it impossible to believe in science and believe in religion? These noted scientists would say there's no harm in believing both because both go together. They fit together hand in hand. Moving more towards the modern end of things, this is Stephen Meyer, a geophysicist and philosopher. He has a PhD from Cambridge in philosophy and also in science. In Lee Strobel's The Case for a Creator, Stephen Meyer quoted, said, I personally take a third approach, which is that scientific evidence actually supports theistic belief. In fact, across a wide range of sciences, evidence has come to light in the last 50 years, which taken together provides a robust case for theism. Only theism can provide an intellectually satisfying causal explanation for all of this evidence. He says theism, at least in his observation, theism, a belief in God, a belief in the divine, a belief in a creator, is the only thing that can provide an intellectually satisfying causal explanation, an explanation for the causes of things, for all of this evidence. As we look around us, as Brother Reef quoted this morning from the 19th Psalm, the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament shows His handiwork. That what we see around us bears the mark of intelligent design. There is some intelligence in back of it. There is a creator somewhere there. Meyer says that's the approach that I am forced to take by examining the evidence that is around me. That there is a creator. He would go on to say this: I believe that the testimony of science supports theism. While there will always be points of tension or unresolved conflicts, and let's appreciate that. If science is about observation and experimentation, we're always going to be seeing some degree of flux in science, right? Science is always kind of reforming itself and reshaping itself and coming to a better understanding, right? I believe that the testimony of science supports theism. While there will always be points of tension or unresolved conflict, the major developments in science in the past 5 decades have been running in a strongly theistic direction. He paused momentarily, then punched to his conclusion, science done right points to God. PhD, Cambridge. Science. What the evidence is that we're seeing today points toward God. Now, you're going to be able to find a stack of scientists on the other side, this high, who say, you know what? There's no room for God. And you're going to find people on both sides, right? It's not going to be too hard to filter through a Facebook feed and find somebody on the other hand who just has absolutely no use for science whatsoever. Are either of those approaches beneficial or helpful? Not really. But we're looking at those voices in the middle, voices of people who are respected in their communities. And here's what they're saying, whether in times past or in times present, that there is not some inherent inconsistency between religion and science. Properly understood, both can go hand in hand. So let's ask ourselves, are there scientific reasons for faith in a creator God? Are there things we can see in the scientific world? Are there things that we can see when observing the sciences that would lead us to a conclusion that it is reasonable to believe in God and believe in a God who was over the creation of the world that we see around us today? Let's talk a little bit about some of the laws that are recognized in science. Let's talk about the first law of thermodynamics, which is exactly what you wanted to do after having a huge meal on a Sunday afternoon, engage in a leisurely discussion of the first law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics states that heat is a form of energy, and energy cannot be created or destroyed. I know there's a lot more to it, but that's a pretty succinct summarization of the first law of thermodynamics. Heat is a form of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. Energy can, however, be transferred from one location to another and converted to and from other forms of energy. Now, our eyes start to glaze over, at least if you're like me. Our eyes start to glaze over a little bit. But we see this in practicality with a caterpillar, right? We have a caterpillar. Then we've got it turning into basically goo in a cocoon, right? And then out from the cocoon comes what? Comes the butterfly, right? And that is, at least in a form, the first law of thermodynamics in action. That some would also say, Fred Herrien being one of them, that you also see some correlation not only to energy, but also to mass. Mass being neither created nor destroyed. You think about the first law of thermodynamics, you think what Isaac Asimov had to say. He was a writer and biochemist. He noted that the first law is considered the most powerful and most fundamental generalization about the universe that scientists have ever been able to make. that this is foundational to our understanding of the universe. This is foundational to our understanding of the sciences. Energy cannot be created or destroyed, but it can be transferred from one form to another, like we see with the butterfly. Fred Herene, who we just mentioned, who is somebody who is noted for his ability to take, and this is not me saying this, this is his peers who say this, who is noted for his ability to take broad scientific concepts that can be very deep, and he is able to explain them in such a way that an audience such as ours is able to really get a foothold in them and understand what's going on. Fred Herene said this, "Neither mass nor energy can appear from nothing. Such an occurrence would be a free lunch, as Big Bang theorist Alan Guth likes to say. Yet there is no denying that the universe is here. So the universe itself appears to be a free lunch. But from the laws of physics we see operating today, creation is impossible as an ongoing event. That is, the conditions that we know hold true in our present universe prevent any possibility of matter springing out of nothing today." It's not spontaneous generation, right? That was something that was debunked a long, long, long time ago, that something appears out of nothing. That's what Herene is leading us to here, that the idea of spontaneous generation just doesn't fit. And that the laws of thermodynamics, specifically the first law of thermodynamics, points out that you can't have something, energy, arising out of nothing. Therefore, if we see the universe here, something had to cause the universe. It doesn't just spring out of nothingness. Because energy and matter, not created, not destroyed. You had to have something pre all of that to bring it into existence. Hebrews chapter 1, and in verse 1. The Hebrew writer had this to say. "God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in His Son, whom He appointed heir of all things, through whom also He made the world. And He is the radiance of His glory and the exact representation of His nature, and upholds all things by the word of His power." Things continue. Things are upheld. Things are in being because of the word of His power. It's certainly a concept that we can see, at least expressed to us in some way, throughout Scripture. The second law of thermodynamics comes into play here as well. It's the idea that as energy is transferred or transformed, more and more of it is wasted. The idea that in any system there is the increase of what is called entropy. The second law also states that there is a natural tendency of any isolated system to degenerate into a more disordered state. We go from everything flowing smoothly to things becoming obstructed, to things wearing down, right? My wife and I she likes to give me a hard time about some of the clothes I wear, as most good wives do to their husbands, I'm sure. To me, it was a noteworthy thing in our marriage that as we began our life together as husband and wife, I had a pair of jeans that I'd had since eighth grade that I could still wear. And I was pretty proud of that. And you're already shaking your head, no, that's terrible, right? She made sure I never wore those again. What had happened to those jeans? Well, any wife will tell you what had happened. They had gotten worn down. They had gotten run down. The holes in them had begun to appear at the knees and things like that. That's what happens, right? More broadly, that's what's happening with the second law of thermodynamics. You have this increase in entropy. You degenerate into a more disordered state. Who has an iPhone? and one of the older forms of iPhones where we just had to do the battery replace, right? What's that? Unless we're buying into the theory that Apple is trying to make us all have to go out and buy more, it's the idea of entropy, right? Everything is running down. That's the idea of the second law of thermodynamics. Everything is running down. Our battery, you get your phone at the start and your battery's going to last you however long, and then you notice 2 years later when it's time for an update, an upgrade, suddenly your battery isn't hanging on that long, and that's how you justify going out and getting the new iPhone, right? Second law of thermodynamics. That's how you convince your parents to buy you a new one, right? Bananas. I had to do this as a nod to Shane. I hate bananas. Shane loves bananas. And he had this whole beautiful slide with banana nut bread. I don't like bananas and I'm allergic to nuts, but I left his bananas up here, right? We see it with bananas in our kitchen, right? They wear down. You go from green to yellow to brown to black. The increase in entropy. Things break down. That's a law we see in the universe when we look at the planets and how they're moving and how the universe is shifting. It's a concept that we see in Scripture. Isaiah 51:6 speaks to it, but we're already here in Hebrews chapter 1. Look at Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 10. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 10. You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hand. They will perish, but you remain, and they all will become old like a garment. What's the they he's talking about there? From verse 10, the heavens and the earth. They will wear down. They will become old like a garment. And like a mantle, you will roll them up like a garment. They will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end. Scientific principle here. One observation with the second law of thermodynamics is the expansion and the decrease of usable energy within the universe. The universe is getting bigger, it is expanding, and it's running down, it's slowing down. And to explain this, some have turned to the concept of a Big Bang. That the Big Bang seems to suit this well, right? You have this amazing event that happens at some definitive point in the past. And this magnificent release of energy. And since that time, entropy has come into play. Everything is slowing down and expanding, and the usable energy in the universe is decreasing. Okay. But how do we get the Big Bang while maintaining consistency with that first law of thermodynamics? Energy cannot be created or destroyed. How do we balance this first law and this second law in practicality when we observe what we observe in the universe? We've got some tension there, don't we? We've got something that's not being fully resolved there. How do we get a Big Bang without a Big Banger? If we could phrase it like that. Would not the voice of God speaking the universe into existence be a Big Bang? Something to consider. Scripture is consistent with the observations of the second law of thermodynamics, and this is what I want us to see. Don't miss this. And trust me, out of anybody else, listen, I'm not trying to undercut my speech here. I hated science when I was in school. Hated it with a passion. But here's something I want us to see. What we read about in our Bibles is not inconsistent with the understood scientific principles of the world. That we can believe in the first law of thermodynamics, the second law of thermodynamics, and Scripture says, all right, you know what? That's legitimate. We read passages like Hebrews 1, 10 through 12, and we see that the world and the universe is running down, is slowing down. That's not a problem. We see God dropping hints about that all throughout Scripture. There's not this some sort of unresolved tension between Scripture and science that will never be overcome. We've got to understand them both and appreciate them and the environments in which they exist. How about this idea of symbiosis? Which is the concept of two organisms living in close proximity in ways that are necessary to the survival of each, right? You've got bees and you've got the flowers that are pollinated by bees, right? The bees have to have the pollen that those plants produce that reap so much joy in the lives of allergy sufferers like myself and you, right? Without that pollen, bees lack the proteins and the fats that they need to continue on in life. The plants are pollinated by bees, and not only by bees. Of course, there are other means of pollinization. But bees are crucial pollinators that allow for plants to reproduce and flourish. You remove one from a system, and what do you lose? Generally, you lose the other. Symbiosis requires these two objects to come into existence with each other. But, for example, as we look at how Darwinian evolution would plot this out, they're not arriving at anywhere close to what you and I would recognize as the same time. There's an issue there. Whereas if we read, for example, the Genesis account of creation, what do we have? We have them coming in at roughly the same time as each other, which allows for this symbiosis to take place, which allows for both to thrive in the environment in which they find themselves. There are scientific principles. Those are just three we've looked at. But there are scientific principles that point to God's existence and to His work, to His intelligent work and His design in creation. But let's get to something we hear more about, the problem of probability, chance, and time. When I was in high school is probably the time in my life where I had the most in-depth religious discussions in my life. We would sit at the lunch table and we would just talk religion. And as I look back on my time there, you had me. I had a friend who was a Baptist, had a friend who was a Catholic, had a friend who was Presbyterian, a friend who was Episcopal, had an agnostic friend, and had an atheist friend. We kind of spanned the whole gamut at the lunch table. And a Mormon friend. Oh, that one in there too. We had some really enlightening discussions, and I wish I could go back to those days and relive some of them and go back into them with some of the understandings that I have now. I'm not so much talking now about interactions we might have with a Hawking type or a Dawkins type scholar. I'm talking about everyday. When we deal with our everyday friends who are inclined to atheism or agnosticism, this is where this study comes into play. We're told, and isn't this what we hear, that given enough time, the probability of something happening approaches one. If you give it enough time, anything can happen, therefore anything is possible is the way that we hear it, right? And that was one of the arguments that my agnostic friend would always put forward, is that, hey, as long as we give it enough time, anything can happen. All that's necessary is having a whole lot of time. You have enough time, that opens up the door of possibility, and if it's possible, because there's going to be enough time, what's possible becomes reality. That's what we're told. And that's what macroevolution requires. I would submit, and I think we've discussed this before, it's almost a dangerous thing for Christians to say, hey, I don't believe in evolution. Evolution is an observed fact. I was showing pictures of my dog at lunch today. I have a part blue heeler, part Australian shepherd. Her name is Olive. She's the best dog in the world. I'm sorry if you love yours. She's the best. You ever think about how we got all the different dog breeds? I had a golden retriever growing up and a labradoodle before labradoodles were popular and then a mutt. How'd they come around? Isn't that evolution? the changes we see. Oh, okay. Evolution is an observed fact. That's not some boogeyman bad word that Christians need to avoid. We can see evolution that has happened. What I would assert that Scripture argues against is this idea of macroevolution. This idea that we have large, whole-scale changes that require thousands and millions of years, that we're altering species here. Somehow we're going from the one-celled organism all the way up to the ape and then on to the human. That's what I dissent from. Now, when we talk about this idea of probability and time and chance and given enough time, anything can happen, well, okay. The chance of these changes occurring, admittedly, is small when considering just a singular object. Just one. But that's not what we're talking about, is it? The probability and time and chance argument that the macroevolutionist has to bring into play, we're considering not one thing but millions and billions and trillions of things if we're going all the way down to the cellular level. Does time really allow that? This is what we're going to see. This argument is going to be greatly based upon chance. Let's see if we can develop that a little bit. I referenced my distaste for The Great Gatsby earlier. I do enjoy reading, though. I like books. The Red Badge of Courage, we read that back in high school. I really enjoyed that one. Adventures of Huck Finn, enjoyed that one. A Separate Piece, that was a good one. Go back to the elementary school days, anyone remember Encyclopedia Brown? Checked those out every time I could at the library. And let's go way back in the day, how about Berenstain Bears? Okay, there's five books right there. Let's take those five books and say that I want to put those five books in alphabetical order on my bookshelf, drawing them out at random. How many ways are there going to be to organize these five books on my bookshelf? And this is when we bring in a mathematical principle called a factorial. That is expressed 5! And that's just pronounced 5! You take 5 and multiply it by 4 and multiply it by 3 and multiply it by 2 and multiply it by 1, and that gives you 120 different arrangements for those 5 books on my shelf. So the chances that I would reach in blindly and get it all in order one time, 1 out of 120, right? Let's step back and make this a little bit bigger. I saw the really nice, I was going to point over here, but I think it's over here. The bookshelf that y'all built in back here, right? We were shown that last night. Big old bookshelf. It's nice. And let's say we have 205, 206 volume set of books that we want to put in alphabetical order on the bookshelf. Well, how many different arrangements are there for those 206 books? And if you wanted to take them and put them in alphabetical order while just reaching in blindfold, I don't know why you would want to do that. Sounds like you might have better things to do with your time than that, but let's just say you wanted to do that. And you're going to put them in order, alphabetical order. How are you going to do it? What's the probability that you get it right on that first chance? So this is another one of our factorials, right? Except this is not 5, this is what? This is 206 factorial. This is 1 times 2 times 3 all the way up to 205 times 206, which gives us 10 to the 388th power. Which, if I have done my counting correctly, ends us up with this lovely number right here. 10 to the 388th power. We've got one more. There we go. I actually counted. That is all the zeros that are supposed to be there. 206 volume of books. Also 206 bones in the human body. The chance of getting that all in order. Blind chance, right? Blindfold ourselves. One in that. And not just happening once, but happening every day as new life comes into the world. But the explanation that we're given, the best approximation we're given, is what? It all happened how? Because there was enough time, it was bound to happen. That's an argument based upon chance. When you look at the body being how it is, it speaks to the incredible wisdom and the power of God. It takes power and intelligence to do what chance cannot. The old watchmaker's argument, right? You don't take the gears and the mechanism from a watch, put them in a brown bag, shake them up, and suddenly the watch appears. That's a simplistic argument, but it expresses the point, at least in a general way. Power and intelligence required to do what chance cannot. Darwin even admitted something close to this when he stated on page 154 of this edition of Origin of Species. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organism existed which could not have possibly been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Darwinian evolution, right? Macroevolution. Small, sometimes maybe even unobserved changes. But over the course of thousands, millions, and perhaps even billions of years, those small, slight changes add up to what? To what we now see in the universe today. But there are some issues with that. How do we move from no sight to sight? Sometimes you have in chemistry and in anatomy and physiology what are described as all or nothing processes, right? How does one move from no sight to sight? I'm not talking about the structure of the eye or anything like that. How do we move from that chemical process of having no sight to sight? With these gradual slight modifications, you don't go from no sight to partial sight to sight. You go from no sight to sight. How do we make that jump? Same thing with hearing, right? How do we go from no hearing to hearing? These all or nothing processes that play out. But perhaps even more than that, a more convincing argument is with DNA. How can we account for DNA and the role that it plays? Get back on that screen. I don't want you yet. There we go. How do we account for DNA? DNA is the medium of the message of life. DNA is at least involved in the process by which we become what we are. You have messages that are encoded, messages that are decoded. How does that all happen? Where does that come from? That's something to consider. And DNA is not this gradual slope that Darwin would picture, that others would picture, where we're making these gradual little changes over successive generations and finally we end up with something bigger. With DNA, it's as though we're at mountain cliff to plateau to mountain cliff to plateau, and we're having to make these incredible, and I mean incredible, jumps that just aren't seen. It's just not feasible. In fact, the co-founder of DNA, Francis Crick, had this to say: an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. That's the co-founder, or the discoverer, not the founder. You don't really found DNA, do you? The co-discoverer of DNA, Francis Crick. J.B.S. Haldeman, a British scientist, said this: We must give up the idea that such an organism, that is, he's talking about the simplest living organism, could have been produced in the past except by a similar pre-existing organism or by an agent, natural or supernatural, at least as intelligent as ourselves, and with a good deal more knowledge. What's he talking about? Design? A designer? A creator? Somewhere in back of all of this, that life didn't just evolve from this simplest little organism. There's something more to it than that. We're talking about time and chance and probability. I promise we're almost done here. Now we get to the colorful part of the presentation and we can see colors and kind of wake up a little bit. Rocks, geology, they form the basis for much of the macroevolutionary thought, right? You see the record of the rocks and you see what the rocks say. Well, fossil record, radiocarbon dating, we've heard a lot about those in times past. Well, here's what the fossil record says. Here's what carbon dating says is the age of this rock, this bone, whatever it might be. Stephen Meyer sums up Darwin's view of this very, very well. He says his theory, speaking of Darwin's, predicts a long history of gradual divergence from a common ancestor, with the differences slowly becoming bigger and bigger until you get the major differences we have now. Darwin believed future fossil discoveries would vindicate his theory. Those are just words. Here's the picture, right? This is Darwin's theory, right? That you start with that first true cell, single-cell organism, and then you explode forward into, from that point, all of the different life that we now see on Earth today. Put a different way, and maybe a more scholarly picture, this is what Darwin expected. Darwin's tree of life, right? You start with that single-cell organism and branch off from there. In reality, what the fossil record shows, especially if this is referenced in your book, if you want to do more time on it, you're welcome to, the Cambrian explosion. What the Cambrian explosion attests in the fossil record is that you have this almost definitive point in time where suddenly you have this mass boom in divergent life. Not this gradual process from a single cell up to multi-cell up to what we see today. The Cambrian explosion tends to lead the interested observer back towards what we see, for example, in the Genesis record of creation. Does the fossil record conclusively demonstrate macroevolution over the course of millions of years? That's what we're told, right? Well, this is what the rocks say. This is what geology says. Geology says that over these millions and billions of years, this is what happened. But, for example, rapid fossilization tends to disprove the common evolutionary model. This is kind of what we're told happened, right? You can't see it very well down here, but we've got kind of our simple organisms down here in this strata. And we move up and we get a little bit more developed, and now we've got some fish here, and we've got some reptiles, and we've got dinosaurs here. And this is kind of how geology works, for lack of a better phrase. That's kind of an overly simplistic model. Because what we actually see, and these are just a few pictures, but they serve to express the real idea. Bruce, are you going to hit that light switch for me, please? So here you go. You have the product of rapid fossilization here. This is a petrified tree that pierced through several strata of geological record. You can see maybe it's dark down here. You've got a coal seam right here. And moving up here, you can see dark as well. That's another coal seam, and you've got different strata in the rock all throughout. We're told that those different strata represent what? Generally, thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of years, each of these strata in rock form. Well, then how do you have a tree? And again, this is not just a one-time thing, you know, way out somewhere in Canada where no one ever goes and you can't ever observe it. Travel around and you see these things. How does rapid fossilization happen? Why does it happen? Why is this tree not consumed by outside forces like fungi, for example? If this fossilization takes place in these stratas of rock over tens of thousands of years, why didn't this tree get cut off by fungi and just be consumed. But yet you've got a 30-foot tree petrified, piercing through several strata of rock. You've got this rapid fossilization that tends to disprove what we hear from our macroevolutionary friends. Does the fossil record conclusively demonstrate macroevolution? How do you get this picture here? This is a fossilized remains of a creature that is giving birth. Still seen within the fossil record if it occurred over thousands of millions of years. You zoom in closer to this fossil and you can see this is a fossil of an animal giving birth. Something happened and this got covered up in layers and strata of rock very quickly, but not enough time to where it could completely disintegrate. How does that happen? Could we maybe see the idea of a universal flood here, bringing in a different environment into the world? Different forces and different pressures? Or how about this? And we wrap up with this one. Friend across the street, when they used to go out of town, they would ask me to come over and watch their house. And one time, and one time only, they asked me to water their plants outside. They had a fern. You ever tried watering a fern and keeping it alive? Doesn't happen. I watered that thing every day, and that thing still turned brown and shriveled in the Arkansas summer, even though it was getting water every day. They're fickle, aren't they? But here's the fossilized remains of a fern. And zoom in on it. And what do you see? You still see the striations that those fern leaves left. You know how quickly, I don't have to tell you, you know how quickly those fern leaves just turn brown and disintegrate. This is rapid fossilization. How does that happen? We're not talking about thousands and thousands of years, are we? We're talking about something that took place quickly. Something changed. Big things changed. What could that be leading us towards? Could it be leading us towards what we see in Scripture? The idea of a flood that changed the world environment? Thousands, if not millions of pounds of pressure being exerted on different layers of the earth's surface. Wholesale changes. It's something to consider. Thanks, Bruce. I appreciate that. So what do we see? We're wrapping up right now. If you've been asleep, nudge somebody. We can wake up and we'll wrap it up right here. What do we see? Belief in God, even the God of creation, is not cause for exclusion from the scientific or philosophic communities. We see philosophers, we see scientists who believed in God, who were respected in their fields. And there's nothing wrong with that. If the discussion is boiled down to simply two positions, we realize both positions require an amount of faith. If we're going to boil this down to either there was a Big Bang billions of years ago, or God created the world by speaking it into existence, both sides require faith. Don't lose that. We can't observe and replicate and experiment with a Big Bang, can we? It's theorized. It's postulated. It requires an amount of faith. Just like belief in God's creation requires an amount of faith, too. Discussions about antimatter and God particles are theoretical. They are observed and are not subject to experimentation. And there is certainly evidence, and evidence which convinced some of the greatest minds among us, of intelligent design and an intelligent designer. I recognize this approach and this study is a little bit different, but I hope you've been able to take something of benefit from it. Remember, if you've got questions, write them down, and we'll do our best to get around and to answer them Wednesday night. But thank you so much for your good attention. Take yourself a very well-deserved break, 7 to 10 minutes, and we'll start back in after that. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.